Dick's Motor, John Somerville. Good morning and welcome. We've read your original submission and all the evidence that you put in, so thank you very much for doing that. It's been very helpful. You don't need to reread that material to us, but you're very welcome to speak to it and highlight key points.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I'm John Somerville, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak on my submission this morning. I'm on the Deer Farmers National Executive and a member of the Southland Branch Committee, and I'm a member of the newly formed Lower Matara Catchment Group and have represented Deer Farmers on Environment Southland Steering Group a number of years ago. I farm with my wife Mel on a mixed stock deer and sheep farm at Pine Bush, which is situated in a rolling country near the bottom of Matara FMU. The deer component, which is 3/4 of the farm, comprises a large percentage mature velveting stags, which are challenging in the winter and a lot are wintered indoors. I've been involved in deer farming for over 30 years, and over the last 15 years have probably fenced off 75 or more percent of the waterways in the deer unit and many in the sheep areas. So I know the costs and work and time involved in repairing fencing. I've completed a FEP level 2 and have also had an Environment Southland farm focus plan and have worked with Environment Southland land sustainability staff along with Landcare Trust on repairing and other management measures on my farm. Farm mitigation measures are documented on the short videos which you have viewed, which were attached as my evidence. As a third generation on the farm and fourth in the district, like many other Southland farming families, we have a long-term commitment to looking after our properties and understanding their strengths and weaknesses, which is essential to sustaining a sustainable farming future. So I'm now going to summarise my thoughts on the rules that I submitted on. And the first one was Rule 20, the farming rule. This involves all dry stock farmers completing a farm management plan and nutrient budget by a series of dates linked to which physiographic zone their farm is in, which is the equivalent of a beef and lamb FEP2. While the farm management plan can be completed by farmers themselves, most will need support, and as mentioned, the deer industry is setting up a code of practice that will give deer farmers a template for assembling their plan with access to good management practices which are applicable for their own situation. Most deer farms, as we mentioned, have other dry stock as part of their farming system, so that's why we work closely with beef and lamb. But the industry's lack of resources means one-on-one support for farmers to complete their plan can't happen, so it takes time and use of resources that I've mentioned to enable this to happen. While the management side can be completed cheaply, the nutrient budget is a whole new ball game. This has been included in this rule to ready farms for the upcoming nutrient limit setting. Completing this will be a big shock for many dry stock farmers, both in the time involved and the preparation and the cost, as I have stated in my submission. And at present, there is a shortage of trained professionals for nutrient budgets, and they will take a long time to complete. Plus, Overseer was not designed as a regulatory tool, and as the Southland Economic Project for Agriculture and Forestry clearly shows with the dry stock farm survey, nutrient losses can be very variable and the mitigations used rapidly reduce profits to unsustainable levels for little reduction in nutrients in many cases. Overseer also overlooks on-farm good management practice with livestock, critical source areas and winter crop areas, and these are some of the cornerstones of successful on-farm environmental management. The fact that these crucial mitigations are outside Overseer greatly reduces its ability as a regulatory measurement that meaningfully addresses impacts on land use and water quality. So the time frame for these plans, is way too tight, and I am concerned that many farmers will find themselves in a consenting system if they fail to meet the deadlines. And details on the farm plans, implementations, and the plan is very lacking. I'll comment on Rule 23, intensive winter grazing. And I understand winter grazing is a huge issue in Southland, with estimated 60,000 hectares cultivated each year for winter crop, and so best practice is essential. The initial draft a couple of years ago that targeted farms that cultivated 15% or more of the total farm area was on the correct track, except the sheer numbers and farms involved, let alone the thousands of paddocks, would have bogged it down into a bureaucratic nightmare. So I guess that is why they changed to larger areas, 50 hectares or over. Except that it inadvertently catches large farms that cultivate over that, but it might be only like 5% of their area, for example. This needs corrected so that the 50 hectare has to be 15% or more before a consent is needed. Most dry stock farms, including deer, use between 5 to 10% of their land area for wintering their own stock. The management in these areas will be part of the farm management plan. The uptake of good management practice of winter crop has been making steady progress in the last 6 or so years, as many farmers are becoming aware of its importance, not only for water quality, but in protecting their capital soils. And also like to comment on the two physiographic zones, Old Matara and Peat Wetland, which have their limit on crop has been set at 20 hectares. I feel that these two zones have been singled out when there's probably other zones that were just as much at risk. There is no indication in the plan how the management of winter grazing will differ in these zones compared to the rest, but due to the small amount of winter crop, a large percentage of farmers in these zones will need a consent. The impact on capital land values in these areas is already apparent. Now, I'd just like to add, the science on physiographic zones needs to be absolute and the boundaries accurate, as what zone you find yourself in can change your life and future forever. I'm going to comment on Rule 25, cultivation on sloping ground. This rule has good intentions but lacks practicality. The rapid climb and setbacks from 3 metres at 3 degrees and then 10 metres at 4 to 16 degrees and then 20 metres to 16 to 20 degrees is highly impractical. I farm in country that changes from flat to steep in very short distances, and applying this rule would be a nightmare. The rule needs to be outcome driven, with obviously a minimum of 3 metres and sensible guidelines so that farmers and contractors are aware of their responsibility in ensuring that sediment does not enter waterways, but back them up to use practical judgment as they set their plough line around a paddock with varying slopes. Farmers should understand how the soil moves on their farm and be aware how to comply. The rule also states that no cultivation should take place on slopes greater than 20 degrees. This should be applied to slopes at altitude and a risk factor with a sizeable area behind them which could cause risk to waterways if cultivated. Not in medium hill country where the steeper slope might only be a small percentage of the overall slope and not in a part of the slope that's going to cause an issue. Good management practice should be encouraged with setbacks and eating off technique. Being too prescriptive and invariably introducing a consenting regime will undermine farmer confidence in what the council was trying to achieve with this rule. And the final rule that I commented on, Rule 70, the stock exclusion part of it from water bodies. Protecting our waterways is very important, but it has to be done in a practical and affordable manner. This rule came out of Policy 18, which aims to reduce sedimentation and microbial contamination of water bodies and improve river and riparian ecosystems and habitats. Unfortunately, the resultant rule has no practical flexibility with impractical timelines to fence off waterways. Rule 70 states that deer will be excluded from water bodies when the slope is 16 degrees or less in a 20 metre distance from it by May 2020, which is only 3 years away. Well, this is highly unlikely to be achieved on deer farms due to the physical and financial cost involved, as we mentioned, up to $24 a metre. So this time frame will mean that pretty much most deer farmers will need a consent to farm. This rule also fails to understand that extensive country with lots of small waterways has a lower stocking rate and a lot less pressure on waterways. Practical mitigations like fencing filter zones or sediment traps and fencing larger creeks lower down will greatly improve water quality. Even on medium and rolling country like where I farm, this rule will be very confusing. from my own experience, as I've mentioned, riparian fencing is very costly and takes a lot of time and good planning. And the Southland Economic Project, which I submitted as evidence, shows that riparian fencing on deer farms improved phosphorus loss using the mitigation of fencing 10% of the properties in the survey, but had a minimal effect on nitrate loss. But it also showed with that 10% of fencing, the farm profit was reduced by an average of 27%. So that shows you how large the cost is. The fencing plan and waterways risk management should be covered under the farm management plan, which allows farms to implement their riparian fencing program in the most at-risk areas first, plus gives farmers ownership of improving their water. Remember, protecting waterways on a deer farm is more than just lines on a map. It is about understanding its topography, livestock characteristics, stocking rates, and managing critical source areas and the best use of any farmer's resources in achieving a result. So to sum up, farmer uptake and implementation of best management practice costs very little, but prescriptive rules implemented under a raft of consents will undermine deer farming and deer and other dry stock farmers' ability to farm and confidence in what the council is trying to achieve. I would urge the planners to consider a more phased approach to getting farmers to complete a farm management plan and work in collaboration with deer, sheep and beef farmers and sub-catchment groups, rather than impose consenting costs and uncertainty on them due to too tight of time frames and unrealistic thresholds for setbacks in winter grazing.
Thank you very much. I'll see if we have questions for you. Morris, we'll start at your end.
Well, thank you. You say that the winter grazing rule should be set at 15% before consent is required, but I note that some of your stock are wintered indoors.
That's correct, yes.
So what I'm suggesting is that wouldn't a restrictive rule, such as the ones that we've got, encourage more people to undertake practices such as this, which appears to be more environmentally sustainable and so help achieve the objectives of the plan?
Not necessarily, because indoor wintering, like, it's very costly, obviously, building sheds and setting up silage pads and such forth. So, in my case, I winter Delvenine stags inside, because they're the highest risk stock on my farm for the nature of their size and that. And it's a lot more efficient for me to winter hinds. They're wintered on crop outside. But the reason I come at that for that rule is that it's, as been mentioned earlier, it suddenly brings a whole lot of large-scale farms into the consent regime, and it's only a small percentage. So I think the council was on the right track with what they were trying to achieve with that, but it obviously becomes a huge issue when you suddenly got a zero on every farm to see what percentage of area they got in crop, and then the rule was confusing initially about whether blocks were joining or not. So, so that's where I decided that to stop farms that have just a still a small percentage being caught by that rule, it would simplify it a lot and reduce the number of farms that would need to consent.
And the second one, can you provide us with the definition of a stream that would include that we could include to help improve environmental outcomes, but is also easily understood by farmers? In your video, you had a stream, and then after a while it got completely overgrown by grass. Presumably it's still a stream, even though you can't really see it.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when, you know, the streams at home, they're only about, you know, barely half a metre wide and about, you know, 4 inches deep. So they're quite small. So when you fence them off, the Coxford grows in that, and so there's water still flowing through them. Water flows through those streams all year round, but obviously in the summer it gets quite low and hardly moves.
So what are the essential characteristics of a stream that we, if we were to define it, we'd need to...
Well, it has to be going all year round.
All year round.
You know, to be a permanent stream, because you just, in some cases, well, all the ones on my farm pretty much run all year round, but at a very slow rate, so...
Isn't that about the width of it or anything?
Well, obviously, it depends on as far as the risk factor you're trying to get it off the stream. Like, it depends on the soil they're in, you know, whether they're muddy bottom or rock bottom, because in a lot of areas there's rock bottom streams, and the damage to them, those smaller ones, is quite minimal. Where they're, if they're muddy, you get a lot more damage, so it varies quite a lot. And plus the intensity of the country as far as the stocking rate.
Okay. All right, thanks, John.
No questions.
Thank you. You talked about a phase in of farm environment management plans. Can you be a bit more specific about time frames on that?
Well, because I just looked at the rule, and obviously there was roughly 3 years, everybody was grouped into whatever zone they were in, and with dry stock farmers, you're coming from scratch and that, and so I would like to see a few more years than that, you know, because just the time frame of actually physically getting everybody up to speed and completing their plans, and particularly the nutrient side of it, like, unless there's going to be a lot more specialists trained to be able to do nutrient budgets, because they take a lot of time, a lot of preparation. So the actual farm plan side of it, it's not that onerous, but the nutrient budget side is, having done a couple myself, it takes a lot of preparation, and that's why I brought up the highlight of the cost, which is so variable, because it's like all those things when you're dealing with professionals, it depends on the complexity of your farm and how well prepared you are, so how much it costs, so you'd be quite variable. And most dry stock farmers have never had any experience with that at all, so you're starting from ground zero, and so that's the main thing that really would cause a lot of problems with the time frame.
Thank you.
And Roy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, the hail stock, do you have discharge consent?
Well, I don't have to under the clock. I haven't got the, with deer you only have, is it 250, I think.
250.
So I don't have that sort of number. And anyone shared, and they're indoors, and it's quite dry, so it's just straw, and then it's taken out of the shed and put through a muck spill onto cultivated paddocks. So there isn't any discharge going anywhere as such, it's contained within sheds.
And in your view, you can have more than one of those on the property?
Yep. Is that my case, they're spread well around, good situations.
And my last question is, do you think the testing of water would help the farm management plan outcomes and drive the right behaviour? Is there a lack of understanding of just what is actually happening?
Well, it can, because I've tested a bit, and of course it highlights the problems with all testing. It's just a spotlight in time, and how it depends on the flow. Like, so you can do a testing at the end of winter, then compared to the dry summer. Like in my case, it was a prime example, those small creeks you're talking about, the water's hardly moving. So when it comes to things like E. coli or whatever and that, you need to have a movement of water, a larger volume, otherwise it just everything just sits still. So that doesn't happen until you get to the bigger water system. So you've got to be careful with the testing. It gives you an idea, but using it as a pass-fail rule, you've got to be quite careful.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, no further questions from me, but I'd just endorse the comments you just made about water testing. It appears a simplistic solution, but it is quite fraught in terms of outcomes. Thank you very much for coming in and presenting to us.
No, thanks for that.
The road